Hello and welcome to Season 3, Episode 15 of Logicast, the AWS News Podcast brought to you by Logicarta. I'm Carl Robinson, CEO and co-founder of Logicarta, and I'm joined, as always, by my esteemed colleague, lead cloud engineer, John Goodall. How are you doing today, John?
Esteemed colleague?
Ooh. That's a new one, isn't it? Yeah.
I wonder if the AI transcription will pick that up. It's going to say, Carl's esteemed colleague.
Depends if it's learned from previous episodes and it might just miss that part. So he doesn't usually say that. So we'll just skip that bit. we're also joined today by Rich House, fellow AWS community builder. Rich, how are you doing, Rich?
Yeah, really good, Carl. Thank you very much for having me.
No worries. Tell us a bit about yourself, Rich. What you do for a living, for the community and so on and so forth.
Yeah, I'm a software engineer for a company called D55. We're a consultancy based up in Manchester. I'm a community builder with the serverless department. and together, I'm 1/4 of the Game Day World Champions, which was Team D55. We won in 2022. And also, we won the F1 Game Day Championship in 2023.
So tell us a little bit about that, because I don't think we've talked about game days before on the podcast. So certainly John and I have attended one. We've never won. We did okay.
No, we came third. We're all right.
We came third. We were on the podium. So, yeah.
But pretty good. It's pretty good.
Yeah. Tell us a bit about what that involves, Rich.
So Game Day is a set of competitions around AWS and their services specifically. The idea is obviously just to promote different services to the community, but it's built around like a narrative arc. So the idea is that they have this really bad startup. It's generally something related to unicorns or something like Unicorn Rentals is their kind of umbrella thing. And they're constantly trying to get themselves into different businesses. So they might be doing like an Uber style service, or they might be doing I think one of them was mining space rocks, for instance. And so they build this narrative around the different services that are being used, and you as game day competitors, you have to link all of these different services together, get them working as best you can, and you accrue points for doing it quickly, doing it in the best way possible. And also once you've done some of the main tasks, there are also ways of kind of managing your resources and things like that can gain you extra points. So it's never, it's generally the competitions are about 4 hours in length, but if you finish early, there's still ways potentially to make extra gains and extra points and stuff like that by managing your services and discussing with your partner, with your teammates how to do that.
Cool. So how many game days did you guys have to compete in to become Game Day World Champions?
So there was a heat and then a semi-final and then a final, I believe, in total. And then, so I was kind of the reserve player, in inverted commas, because we didn't really know if I was going to be able to compete or not. So I only got the phone call like 20 minutes before it was set to happen. I was actually picking my daughter up from school and had to run back. And then because...
Did you leave her there?
I lost the time specifically for it. No, I didn't leave her there. It was just... I managed to get home in time. But she then had brownies to go to later that evening. So the game had just about finished. We had about 20 minutes or so. So I got on my phone and went and picked her up and brownies. I was stood outside kind of cheering because we were slowly becoming more sure that we were going to win. And all these parents are looking at me very, very oddly. It was great.
Fantastic. And I think I saw from your socials that you guys did actually get a trip to the F1 Grand Prix out of this. Is that right?
Yeah, so that was for the 2023 F1 championships. Yeah, for that prize, that competition, the final was actually kind of, it was done live, but we had to go into the Manchester offices and they had all the different AWS offices from all around the world competing at the same time. And that was a great experience. And then, you know, like you say, the prize was a trip to the F1 out in Texas, which was... it was absolutely incredible. It was all things F1, all things America, all things AWS, just combined to create this incredible atmosphere, really. And they looked after us so well, it was ridiculous. We got to go into the pits, we got to go into the paddock and kind of walk where all the F1 drivers were. We got to go on the pit wall at one point. It was just insane.
Awesome. Well, normally our tangents are nothing to do with AWS. Game Days wasn't on the agenda, but that was quite a relevant tangent for the listeners, hopefully. So, if you've never heard about AWS Game Days before, check them out, because obviously, as Rich has shown, it could well be in your interests to do so. Anyway, as I say, we're not here to talk about Game Days. As regular listeners to the podcast will know, I curate a list of AWS news once a week, which I share via my AWS News Roundup newsletter. And then John and I pick a set of articles from the newsletter that we'd like to talk about with our guests on the podcast. So we do, of course, have a selection of articles. So let's just dive straight into the first one this week, which is just a mini article, more of an announcement, really, that Amazon Bedrock is now available in the Asia Pacific Sydney region. So, John, ever been down under?
No, I'm just thinking of all sorts of. That's not a knife. This is a knife. Pulls out a spoon. That's a spoon. No, I have never been to Australia. I have extended family out there who I've never met because I've never been and they've never come here. But whatever, I might go eventually.
You might run some models there, though.
No. I picked this one because Bedrock is following a bit of an odd rollout pattern, I've noticed, I believe. Me. Because when I started trying to play with it for, and I kind of alluded to it in the intro a few times now, started playing with it for transcribing and then writing up transcriptions and show notes and stuff for this podcast, and there's a fly there. That's really annoying. Keeps getting in shot. Just stop being such a limelight hogger.
Get your chopsticks out. That would look.
I'm not
great.
Mr. Miyagi.
You need to build some AI to get rid of the fly.
I need to just bring the cat in here. Should do it. But yeah, I tried to run it kind of in London because I thought I'm near London. That's my local region. Cool. I'll put it that. It's not available in London. Okay. Fine. Let's run in Ireland. That's pretty common. Ireland gets things before London does. It's not in Ireland. What? So it's a bit like, okay, that's weird. So yeah, it's following a bit of an odd rollout pattern because it's done a couple of bits of the US, which you sort of expect because the US gets everything first. And then it's done Tokyo and Singapore, which don't normally get things that early, but they've gotten this quite early. Frankfurt and Paris, okay. GovCloud, which never gets anything first. And now Sydney. Right. Have they just designed this rollout based on where people want to go on a business trip?
It could well
almost
be.
Definitely.
Got it.
Have you got it?
I think so.
Nice.
Good work.
So, Rich, have you been playing with Bedrock yourself?
Yeah, I've done a few things. I've got a presentation for the Manchester User Group tomorrow, actually, where I'm doing some step function stuff, and I've got some Bedrock involved in there. Been doing a bit of Party Rock as well, obviously, which is a great way for people kind of to dip their toe in the water and stuff. I was playing with some Mistral stuff most recently because I think Mistral Large is the most recent one that they've added. Not massively impressed with them so far. I always think the first thing I do is go onto their kind of chat bots and play around with that, like you would do with like everyone did with ChatGPT. And the questions that I ask them are always to solve cryptic crosswords and stuff like that, because I think that's quite a high level of kind of understanding. And Mistral's Le Chat did very badly.
Which models performed well in that particular test?
GPT-4's done okay. Claude, I think, did all right. I can't really remember. But
Got like a dozen models now.
Yeah.
Opus isn't on Bedrock yet, but no. Like Claude 3, what is it, Sonnet, like the middle one, has come out pretty recently. And
Yes.
I mean, we're using Claude 2 because that's just kind of what I was using, is what was available. And then Claude 3 has a completely different input structure. So I need to rewrite all my code to work with the new input structure. So
yeah, and just... I noticed that actually with the step function stuff I was doing, I ended up using Claude Sonic because it takes the most tokens as well, so you can give it the biggest input. And what I found was exactly that. The template for the kind of input on the step functions workflow isn't right, and as soon as you hit it, it says you can't do that. So you've got to then go back through, find all the docs, and turn it into the message API, I think is what they call it now. Once you've got that working, it works really well. And like you say, Claude Sonnet, it's probably the strongest now that's on Bedrock. It's working quite well.
So what's your demo do? What are you demoing tomorrow at the user group?
I'm actually demoing some of the stuff from reInvent 2023 that they announced. So Redrive was one of the things that they announced just before. So I'm talking about that and kind of how that makes your testing easier or your debugging a lot easier. I'm also significantly less expensive, and also much less infuriating when you've got a 20-minute step function that fails at the last bit.
Yeah.
And then talking a little bit about HTTP endpoints, and also the test scenario, the direct testing of tasks. So yeah, talking about all that kind of stuff.
Cool. Sounds good. Well, I'm conscious of time, so let's skip on to our second article for this week, which is a slight change of pace. It's another feature announcement from AWS. This one's all about AWS IAM Identity Center, now offering a streamlined AWS access portal and shortcut links. And I read this with interest, thinking this is something that I could use from my limited use of AWS. I would have linked straight to the billing page so I'd have to go via the access portal. So I got quite excited about this, but what about you, John? Do you get excited about this one?
I got excited on your behalf, Carl.
Oh, thanks, John. Yeah. You can make it work for me.
I'm going to have to anyway. That's my job. Bloody fly. God damn. I've got it. I've ripped one of its... Yeah, it's dead now. There we go. No more fly. I only took four attempts. That's embarrassing. IAM Identity Center, and I'm not going to be using that clap to sync the video feeds. We'll just pretend it didn't happen. Right, let's do the basics. Let's do some definitions. I've done this a couple of times, but new listeners and all the rest of it. Right, old-fashioned way of logging into AWS is with an IAM user. You shouldn't be doing that anymore because... Have I got more flies in here? Jesus Christ. I'm going to have to get an exterminator in my shed. Right, you shouldn't be using IAM users anymore. And Carl's going to... reach through the screen and give me that. Thwack, thwack. You shouldn't be using IAM users anymore. They're not considered particularly secure, and they're limited to one account. You can put MFA on them, but MFA on an IAM user doesn't work very well. It's kind of clunky. It's kind of hard to enforce. You have to do these weird sort of policies for it. And like I say, it's limited to one account and you have long-term credentials. And that's kind of the biggest problem, is you have to go in and rotate things like access keys, which is, you don't want to be doing that. Identity Center, formerly AWS SSO, now IAM Identity Center. And for a little while, the service name was IAM Identity Center, brackets, formerly AWS SSO, brackets. Which is cool.
Like the artist formerly known as Prince.
Yeah.
Who was then Prince again afterwards for a bit. Yeah. and in the same vein, the permissions for IDC are still SSO if you start writing policies for it. So it's like, okay, cool. That's the newer way of doing things across an organization. So across multiple accounts. Much better because you have one login, single sign-on, hence it was called SSO for a bit. Across all of the accounts that you have access to within the organization. They're managed centrally, which is great. You can hook them into external identity providers, IDPs. So you have an IDP for IDC. They didn't think this through at all. and it can be, it can be hooked up with SCIM, so you get group provisioning and stuff, and it all kind of works quite well. We use it internally. We deploy it for our customers. Brilliant. Love it. What this is now doing is giving you a way of saying, I have logged in. I am now Carl. I want to get directly to this service in here, please. Go. And it will do that for you. That's great for lazy people. It's also good for people who have very limited access to things and you don't want them to have to be either navigating through bits of the console and seeing just seas of red text, or there are certain bits where you want them to be able to say, see the contents of one particular S3 bucket, but not be able to look at all of them. And then that kind of breaks the console if you want to do that. So this is good. This takes you exactly where you need to be. Logged in. Bosh. Done.
So where does the link exist? You still got to go in via IDC to log in, have you?
Yeah, you're going through IDC. I haven't looked into it in enormous detail, but basically what they're saying is it's a shortcut link, so you save it as like a browser bookmark or whatever.
Yeah, and if you were going to look at my screen right now, you'd see the first one that I've created just right in the middle, because I discovered this completely separate to your you guys talking about it. I was on IDC and just kind of went, "What? Why is this blue banner? What's that information about?" And I was like, "Oh, very interesting." And it's great. We use it for we've got CloudWatch dashboard for one of our clients, and every morning I was having to go through my single sign-on login, then go to CloudWatch, then go to dashboards, then go to this dashboard. But now I press one button, do my sign-in, and I'm already there. And the other thing that I've been using it for is sharing links for across teams or whatever you're using to say, oh, can you have a look at this? Usually you do that and then the person would go, oh, hang on, I've got to change which user I'm in, all that kind of stuff. And this takes them straight there. Perfect. They're in. My only criticism is that you have to go out into the IDC in order to generate the link. There should be a way of just hitting it from the console and it generates it from the page that you're on. That's the only thing I'd like to see from it.
Feature request.
Technical issue. Yeah. There's a technical issue there, though, isn't there? Because when you actually go into the console for an account, you're not actually in IDC anymore. You're in an assumed role.
Yeah.
So you're sort of in Federated IAM at that point. So I get why that's hard to do.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm sure they've already thought about it and there'll be reasons why it wasn't there initially. But yeah, like you say, feature request for the future.
Nice. But on balance, we all like it. Great. Thumbs up for access portal shortcut links. So let's skip on to...
Yes, I have.
Nice. Have we done that before? I'm not sure we've done that before.
I don't know. We might. I think we've done this before because I count on my thumbs. So that's happened once or twice.
It happens all the times in meetings by accident. But, Moving swiftly on to our next article for this week, which is on the AWS database blog. And it is a list of 5 AWS tools to help you optimize your Amazon RDS costs. So we talk a lot about cost optimization on the podcast. This specifically is around optimizing costs for RDS. So I'll come to you first, John. Walk us through the first couple, and then Rich can talk to us about some of the others.
I mean, that's kind of not what I wanted to talk about on this. I mean, we'll talk through them in a minute, but obviously there's others that they don't touch on, because it talks about things like Trusted Advisor, and it'll tell you about idle DBs, over and underutilized, multi-AZs, configuration recommendations, and so on and so on. It doesn't really talk about the obvious stuff, which is odd. You'd have at least thought they'd have gone, you can do reserved purchasing here, and that saves you a bunch of money. You can do that. It's odd that they didn't at least go, this is kind of boring, but it's the easiest way of saving a bunch of money. Bink. Do some reserved purchasing.
Yeah, isn't that buried within the cloud intelligence dashboards bit of the article?
Maybe. But yeah. So the first one it goes call out, which is good, but again, I take issue here, is Trusted Advisor. Trusted Advisor is great. It's a great service if you have access to it. And that's a big if, because you have to be paying for business support. And that is then, it's not horrifically expensive if you're a low spend customer, it's like $100 a month per account. But then if you're running business support on several hundred accounts, that's then several thousand dollars for, you might not need it and you get, oh, one extra service. Okay, great. It's good. The recommendations it spits out are really good, but I dislike that it's paywalled, even partially. Yeah, that's just a, why have they tied that up with support? That's, I don't understand why that's been done. That's a, like someone like, I would very rarely, in my entire life, when I had access to support, I've contacted AWS support, I think, twice. And one of them was a billing query, which you get anyway. And one of them was, can you confirm that this behavior in CloudFormation is a bug, please? Yes, it's actually a bug. You've not done anything wrong. Okay, brilliant. That's like, and that's not me bragging. That's, I think, fairly normal for most engineers. You don't really talk to them that often.
No, so... I've never had any reason to contact them, I don't think, when I've been working.
Yeah, so the fact that this is paywalled behind that, I'd really like Trusted Advisor, and the checks it spits out are great, and these ones are great. I don't want it to be paywalled, though.
Yeah, exactly. If you're talking about cost optimization, the idea of spending, what, $100 in order to save $95 doesn't feel like an optimization.
No.
Absolutely not. What about the instance scheduler, then?
Oh, I'm a big fan of that. I've deployed that, I think, a dozen times now. There's a number of ways to skin that particular cat, and the cat's not in the bed right now, so I can say that, and she won't get annoyed.
Is she already skinned?
No, she's upstairs making a bed furry. Fair enough. There's a number of ways of shutting down RDS on a schedule and bringing it back up on a schedule. Instant scheduler is the one that people point to because it also does EC2, it's very configurable. It costs maybe $5 a month to run because you have to deploy it to your own account. It's all kind of pre-done, but you sort of go, deploy, here's my schedules. Great. It costs like a fiver to run. And it can save you loads and loads and loads and loads of money. But there's a number of ways of skinning that particular cat because you can use custom lambdas and there's an RDS-specific one that's been developed and so on and so on. But, excuse me, generally, turn stuff off when you're not using it. No complaints. Turn stuff off.
I think the only thing I wanted to add to that, and I massively agree, I think one of the other things that I'm kind of quite heavy on within D55 and just the greater industry is good mental health, and I'm a mental health first aider and an advocate for good mental health. And from that point of view, it's actually a bit of a double-edged sword because you're absolutely right, turn the schedule off is great, saves a bunch of money. It also kind of enforces people to stop working quite so many extra hours, which can be great and wonderful. But from another point of view, if you're one of the advantages of working from home or working in this industry is that you can kind of choose your hours, that is then restricted by scheduling your instances. So it's always... Yeah, it's something that I would always be mindful of, is that I don't want to inhibit people's elasticity of their work. But at the same time, I'm sure you are guilty of just popping on for another couple of hours and doing a little bit of extra work. And if you know that your instances are shut down and you'd have to manually start them up in order to do it, you're probably not going to do that quite so often.
Yeah, fundamentally, yes. No. I'm regimented about that. I'm done. That's it.
Yeah, fair enough.
I could see it could be a driver of stress, though, if you're kind of rushing to finish something and you're thinking, it's going to be turned off in a minute and I just need to get this, you know, these last few lines of code written, or this query written or whatever it might be. And you get halfway through and, oh, damn, the infrastructure's gone off.
Yeah, or if you're looking for a bug late at night and you suddenly realise you can't, you know, can't switch anything on or get anything done, but generally, absolutely cost saving, perfect for.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's not an angle I've ever thought about, to be honest, on the scheduler, but certainly worth bearing in mind. What about the point on AWS backup then?
I didn't think of it as a cost saving measure per se, but it kind of makes sense because AWS, like it says, AWS RDS. Does backups for you. You just tell them how long you want it to keep them for, and it will handle the taking and the aging out and all the rest of it. Great. If, however, you need to retain them for longer than that, because there's a maximum of like 35 days or something, or you want to move them to cheaper storage, or you need to take them more frequently than daily for one reason or another, then you're doing what's called a manual snapshot. It's not always manual. Manual snapshot to me implies you go push button, it does it. But other things, calling the API counts as a manual snapshot. Right. AWS Backup is technically doing a manual snapshot for you, but it's automating all of that. So you can take them more frequently. You can take them less frequently, if that's, you know, applicable to your use case. You can keep them for longer. You can move them to cold storage. And all of these things just reduce the cost of holding your backups. Because whilst AWS does, frankly, magic it with their backup management, in that you get charged for the first full backup, and then all of the increments are only charged at the date of change, which is great. But you don't need to care about that. It's just there. You just restore the one that you want, and it's all just there. I mean, 10 years ago, I had to care about, this is our weekly full backup, and then we do daily deltas. And then if you want it to look correct, you've got to deploy the full backup and then the deltas up to the point. That was awful. AWS have dealt with that, so you don't have to care. But fundamentally, that's what you're doing. Because backup is then doing, you know, even more magic, your costs for keeping significantly more aren't going up significantly, which is great. And then moving it to cold storage, it's going back down again. Brilliant. Love that.
Anything to add on the backup, Rich?
Not really. I mean, I just kind of make sure you kind of keep an eye on that cold storage stuff, make sure that your life cycle's working so you're not got a bunch of backups going through using the most expensive storage that you can possibly do, which people, you know, tend to forget quite often. But yeah, I'm pretty much in agreement with what John was saying.
So this next bit was quite interesting to me as well, the cloud intelligence dashboards. It's not something I've come across before. Obviously, I knew about QuickSight, knew you can create dashboards, wasn't aware that they got these kind of pre-canned dashboards that can be used for cost optimization. So is this something you've used, Rich?
No, I was as pleasantly surprised as you were, because I'd used the next point on quite a lot, CloudWatch dashboards, as we discussed before. So yeah, having something that will just kind of look at your cost optimization straight away is incredibly useful, and seems, from what I've seen of it, fairly intuitive. The thing about CloudWatch, which I was going to mention afterwards, is that the dashboards are great and they're so kind of customizable and wonderful, but there is a learning curve in kind of reading them and understanding what they do and how that applies to your cost saving. So if you can have that all taken care of for you, and you can just see, do that, that will be better, then yeah, win-win.
Yeah, I know you had a quick look at this yourself earlier, John. What were your thoughts on it?
Yeah, I love an out-of-the-box dashboard, because whilst, you know, dashboards are great, if you have to make them, I'm not going to bother, because it's awful. I hate making dashboards. I like looking at them. I've made enough dashboards when I was a junior engineer trying to earn some sort of credit for it. I don't like doing them anymore, because if they're done by default, great. I don't think these are free. I think because it's using things like QuickSight and so on, there's small charges involved here, but it's probably not horrific. But I had a play around with the demo dashboards. I liked what I saw. I did. Again, there's one that pokes back into the Trusted Advisor thing. So you need to have access to Trusted Advisor to have access to this dashboard, because otherwise you just get lots of empty widgets, and that's no fun for anybody. But generally, no complaints with this. This was a nice little accidental find.
Nice. So I think we've kind of covered the CloudWatch point as well, just in talking about the dashboards. So let's move on to our next article for this week. This is an article on the Register defending US East 1, because it gets a lot of stick, US East 1, as the home of most AWS outages. Perhaps that's a little bit unfair, but you know, the Register are always happy to report when there is an outage. So it's nice to see a little bit of defense going on here for US East 1. What were your thoughts on this one, John?
I mean, I like to bash East 1 as much as the next guy, but 5 years ago, it was warranted. I don't think it is so much anymore. It used to be really awful, and it's okay now. Like, it's fine. Yes, it's probably, I think it's the biggest in terms of number of data centers. It gets the majority of new things first. So the first place to get new features at hyperscale is going to be the buggiest. Cool. If you can live with that, go hog wild. Go mad. If you can't live with that, use Oregon.
Yeah, I think exactly what you're saying. You know, if you've suddenly, if you've trying out a new service or whatever, and it's in US East 1, and then you want to expand on that, you're already in US East 1. Why would you then go, hang on one second, I just need to protect everything, I'm going to move things around? I think one of the thing that I kind of drilled down on was, yeah, they're saying it's not that flaky, and it isn't that flaky anymore. But also, you wouldn't be spending $35 billion in 15 years if you were absolutely, you know, so happy with the way your infrastructure is working. So there are issues there, and they are trying to make sure that it's sorted. But for the main part, it's got the most traffic, it's going to have the most problems. I think it's a fairly obvious statement to make.
Yeah.
Do you tend
the biggest
to,
issue for East 1 that I've found, and it's not an issue so much as an annoyance with their architecture, and AWS have taken steps to kind of undo this, but lots of global services, apparently global, run through East 1. Yeah. Billing runs through East 1. CloudFront runs through East 1, regardless of whether you're deploying to it or not. Big chunks of CloudWatch metrics actually hook through East 1, I've found. So if you've got like an external monitoring tool, you can't not grab from East 1 because there's so much coming out of there.
Do you tend to avoid it for workloads?
Yeah, I try to. I mean, obviously, we work with European countries, so we tend to have our stuff in Europe for either latency issues or just for ease of use, all that kind of thing. I would only ever go to US East 1 if I absolutely have to. For instance, if I was doing some LLM stuff right at the start and had to go in there for Bedrock.
We've got some US customers, John. Are they in US East 1?
A couple of them are. Yeah, it's fine. It's one. The biggest thing is it's not to don't use East 1 because it's flaky. It's don't use US East 1 if you're not near there.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Which applies to any of the regions, really. But cool. Okay, guys, I'm conscious of time. We have got one more article, but we're running a little bit short on time. I think John probably picked this one because it's about cats, and we've already spoken about cats a number of times already before we even got to the article. But actually, it's not about cats. It's about an engineer who also likes cats, like John. Mm. But this engineer's got more cats than John. This is an article on Amazon's own about Amazon website about an engineer called Tom Scholl, I assume his name is pronounced. Who collaborates with networks across the globe to stop cyber attacks by tracking traffic from bad actors at its source. And he's got a collection of about 100 different cat t-shirts that he wears to work, which if you go and have a look at the article, there's a lovely little gif of him alternating between all of his different cloud t-shirts. But obviously, cat t-shirts. Cats in the cloud. Obviously, this article is primarily about stopping IP spoofing attacks. So I guess that's what we should talk about, really, rather than cats or t-shirts.
I mean, there's no technical meat in this article. It's much more on a here's a really clever engineer. Here's a load of cool stuff that he's done. This one man has fundamentally moved the needle on this, which is incredible. And he likes cats. Cool. Okay, I just think there's nothing really to discuss here, especially given the time that we've got. But I think everyone should go and read this because it was a very interesting article.
Yeah, and I think the things that came out of me from it were he is obviously an incredibly intelligent man and he's very dedicated, very good at his job. So his soft skills are in some ways as important as his technical one because they talk about a lot of kind of discussion with other companies and stuff and negotiations and things like that. I think that collaboration is just as important as automation in that kind of thing when you're doing stuff that is, like you say, the tip of the spear technological work. And also, if you like something, don't tell your colleagues unless you want 100 t-shirts about it.
You think it's his colleagues that have bought him all of those? Then?
Well, All I know is that I really like gin, but the reason why I tell people I really, really like gin is because they always buy me gin for Christmas. So
Nice. Yeah. Good tactic. Good tip there. I'm going to might use that one myself. Not for gin though, for whiskey. I mean, the soft skills side of it is very interesting because I guess it applies to all aspects of tech, not just IP spoofing attacks, but it's one thing to know what the problem is. It's another thing to convince somebody else to do something about it, which I guess is what he spends a lot of his time doing. So, and I guess that's what we all spend a lot of our time doing as engineers and as salespeople in the tech industry. We know there's a better way, but convincing other people that the better way is the right way for them is sometimes a challenge. So,
yeah, exactly. And you know, AI is obviously becoming all encompassing now, and it's just going to get bigger and bigger and bigger. But there's always going to be need for people with incredible skill sets that are also great at engaging people, getting people to work together on big projects or small projects, or even just minor little tweaks and things. And AI is not going to be able to replace that anytime soon.
Absolutely not. So on that note, I mentioned we were running a little short on time. We have reached the end of our time for season 3, episode 15 of Logicast. So thank you. If you've made it this far, thank you for listening. Thank you for watching. Thank you, Rich, for your insights. It's been great to have you on as our guest. And thank you, John, as always, for your insights. You don't really have a choice. You're here every week, except when you're on holiday. But
then we take a podcast break, so it's fine.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But that was season 3, episode 15 of Logicast. Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed it, tell your friends. You can find us wherever you download your podcasts. If you want to see what we look like, or if you want to see John catching flies during this week's episode, we're also available on YouTube. We'll be back next week with another episode of Logicast. We'll see you again next time. Cheers.